Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast, where we're feeling the burn after Anna Burns carried off the 2018 Man Booker Prize with Milkman.
Your Royal Highness, my lords, ladies and gentlemen, friends of literature in the many dialects of this language we all love, our celebration of the Man Booker Prize should begin with the writers who have brought us together, the more than 170 novelists we judges read and discussed. Fiction in English, we can report, is in splendid shape, at least in its more ambitious tiers. The winnowing has been hard, there was so little chaff. Because the finalists were so marvellous, picking just one of them was enormously challenging, but in the end, out of the pleasures and rigours of our year-long conversation, has come this year's winner. I can tell you now what even I did not know this very morning, and announce that the 2018 Man Booker Prize for Fiction goes to Anna Burns for Milkman.
We'll be hearing from the poets Kate Tempest and Don Patterson later, but with me in the studio are Claire Armitstead and Charlotte Higgins to discuss a Booker upset. So what was it like in the room when the announcement came, Claire?
Well, I would use the word electric were it not a cliché. And this is the sort of book that makes you examine your clichés and also all your previous opinions in my case, because I have to say I've been frantically reading all six of the books, and this was the one that I least thought was going to win. And it having done so, I'm now examining my prejudices, and I think that it is a book that rewards both rereading and also hearing aloud.
Yeah, because it's about the voice, is it?
It's got this amazing voice, yes. A young woman, a young Irish woman. It's very, very intrinsic. And when I say you can't use cliché when you're talking about Anna Burns, is she dismantles every single cliché you possibly could think of, doesn't she? Societal and psychological, political.
Maybe we should say, what's the setting for people who haven't read it yet?
The setting is an unnamed Northern Irish town in the midst of the Troubles in the 1970s. And I must say, I have to say that I absolutely love this book. I haven't read the entire shortlist, so I can't say whether I think it was absolutely the best of the bunch, but I just think it's wonderful, and it's absolutely on the nail in terms of being the book for now, in my view. So yeah, the setting is it's a sort of awfully claustrophobic sense of things going very badly wrong, a violent, oppressive environment. The main character is a young woman, 18-year-old. And as Claire says, she has this extremely strong internal voice. One of the first things we see her doing is walking along the street reading, and she's reading, of all things, Walter Scott's Ivanhoe. You think, why is she reading? It's so interesting, you know, when a character in a book is reading a book, it's a
declaration of intent, isn't it?
You really want to, well, why is she reading Ivanhoe? And I thought about this, and one of the things I think is it's possibly because this setting of 1970s Ireland, in one way, is almost as distant, right, to us as a kind of English medieval romance would have been to this young girl reading in 1970s Ireland. And it suggests a kind of mythic quality, which I think comes through the book. Partly, none of the characters have names, so they're all referred to by, like, middle sister, that's the name of the protagonist, or milkman, that's the name of
nearly boyfriend.
Or nearly boyfriend, or nearly ex-nearly boyfriend, all that kind of thing. And this nickname of this incredibly dominating and sinister character, milkman, who, you know, imposes himself in various ways on the main character. But the two reasons I thought it's just unbelievably timely are, first of all, actually because of the Irish Troubles setting. I mean, if our cabinet could be made to read one book right now that might tell them about you know, the ghastly things that could be unleashed if a Brexit agreement isn't made pretty quickly about the Irish border. You know, it's this book. This
do not go back here.
Exactly so. And the second thing is this very acute, perceptive, penetrating look at gender relations, which so it's absolutely on the nail of the Me Too era. This woman who is threatened by this kind of, you know, overwhelming character from the Milkman.
There's been a lot of talk in the news coverage about it being a challenging read. What do you make of that, Claire?
Well, I think it is because you have to absolutely buy into the voice. You have to go with the voice and you have to stay with the voice. And I think that is quite challenging. I think we're quite fidgety readers now. And compared with the other novels on the shortlist, I think it's the one that you have to work to get into. But I think Charlotte's absolutely right. Absolutely does reward it. You mentioned Ivanhoe, but she also, this protagonist mentions Tristram Shandy and Dostoevsky. So she's playing, conjuring up a sort of literature, which is a playful literature, but also literature which disturbs reality. And the whole act of reading becomes the most subversive thing you can do. There's this lovely line where somebody says to her, "It's disturbing, it's deviant, it's optical illusional, not public-spirited, not self-preservation, calls attention to itself. And why? With enemies at the door, with the community under siege, with us having to pull together, would anyone want to call attention to themselves here?" To which the protagonist answers, "Hold on a minute. Are you saying it's okay for him to go around with Semtex, but not okay for me to read Jane Eyre in public?"
Right. So, yeah, there's this sense of a society that's completely closed into its own norms. And violence has become absolutely the norm, and she's stepping outside of that with
but her reason. There's no kneecapping all those cliches of Northern Irish life, is
well,
there?
It's the old explosion.
It's sort of in the background. It's absolutely in the background. She, you know, obviously we know that that's where she lives.
But no, I suppose what I mean is it's almost like a dystopian novel in that it's a society locked into its own norms and ways of speaking and doing things. And that's beautifully described, like the way you can tell who's from whose side by the way they talk about bread, or, you know, the kind of incredible particularity of language that demarcates people's political views or where they stand on certain things. And it's absolutely closed down and particular, and yeah, the sort of oppressive little world she has an out of, because she has the sort of the act of reading to help her. I mean maybe this is, you know, people are incredibly personal about reading, you know, headline. I found the voice immediately very attractive. I found it a much easier read, as it were, than recent winners like Paul Beatty, which I loved, but I didn't find it easy. Eleanor Catton, Ditto, I really enjoyed it, but I had to kind of, you know, plug myself in very consciously. This I felt just whipped along for me. So, you know, it's a very personal thing. People have talked about, you know, it doesn't go in for paragraphs very much, and it doesn't go in for much punctuation, and the characters don't have names. I think as long as you allow yourself to be swept away by the voice, it is like someone speaking in your head, you're well away. I would give this to people. I would recommend it to people. It's that kind of book for me.
It's interesting that it wasn't, I think it didn't completely come alive for me, if I'm honest, until I heard it being read out loud. And that's something that I noticed with Colm Toibin's novels as well, that, you know, I'm a huge fan of Colm Toibin, but I don't think I really understood the way that language and syntax and voice are the intelligence of the novel until I heard it in audiobook. And I think that is true of this novel.
And again, something that you say felt different the second time around for you, Claire.
Yeah, once you've got that, then you go back into it and it's just, you know, every page buzzes, basically. You
know, in some sense, is that the kind of book that booker judges should be rewarding? The one that merits rereading, that merits a getting into in a kind of deep way?
Yeah, I just think we have to get away from this should. I mean, I think that, actually, I think they put together a very interesting and good shortlist. You know, I really loved Richard Powers' The Overstory. I know a lot of people said it was overwritten, but I just absolutely loved the structure of it, the way it dealt with sort of nature, the idea that trees become a different form of love. I loved Robin Robertson's The Long Take, which actually is more radical formally because it is basically a poem than this. So I think it was a really good list, and this is a good novel. And I mean, I think that it probably won't sell in huge numbers.
I think it's already done reasonably well.
It's certainly done very well in Ireland.
Yeah, it's done well in Ireland. I agree with your contention about should. I mean, booker judges just do what booker judges do, right? And I don't think anyone can really predict what happens. I mean, it's a group of individuals that they'll have a particular dynamic on a particular day, and all sorts of peculiar things can happen in those rooms. You know, Julian Barnes was totally right when he called it posh bingo. I'm glad that she's won from one very particular point of view, and we know that our colleague Lisa Allardyce is interviewing her this morning, and I'm really looking forward to reading that article, not least because in the acknowledgements to Milkman, Anna Burns thanks her local food bank. You think, well, and it was clear that she hasn't got very much money, and I was thinking, gosh, was she a client of that food bank?
Yeah, she talked about, at the press conference, she talked about having gone to the Royal Literary Fund. I think that she has lived in, you know, it's the old Garrett syndrome, basically, and she talked about waiting for the voices to come along. And there's something very sort of pure about it, and, I mean, how extraordinary that she should go on something like 16 years, I think it was, after she last came to any notice and win the Booker Prize. And
that was a wonderful thing, a wonderful story for her, isn't it? I mean, don't try this at home, kids, because this is like lightning striking. But good for her. It's nice to think she'll be able to pay off some debts and not maybe go to the food bank.
And, you know, and I have to say, for all that there's no should about it, the Booker people are going to be very happy that it's not an American male with all the stuff that's been going on about America. It could quite possibly have gone to an American male. It was a very strong, they were all quite strong books.
And it's the numbers are kind of moving in the right direction. I mean, historically there's, I think, 34 winners, of whom 17 have been women. And in the last 10 years, there have been 6 men and 4 women, 2 of which Hilary Mantel. So another woman is a move in the right direction, perhaps.
I think it's more, I think for the Booker Prize itself and those who run it, I think probably, I guess, less about gender and more about this whole American question about whether it was right to change
also
the
about
eligibility.
Form, about formal seriousness, and this is a formally very serious book, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think the stuff they're talking about at their board meetings is more like the eligibility rules, you know.
Oh yeah,
and it has been, you know, staggeringly unpopular among British publishers to have extended the remit out to American novels and British authors too, because it just feels like British authors, you know, just don't really have a great chance anymore. I mean, this is the first Northern Irish winner, so that
well, in itself is kind of fantastic.
The,
yeah, but I mean, the irony of that is that this is the first Northern Irish novel, and for most of the life of the Booker, Northern Irish novels have been eligible, you know, and actually there have been. There is a fiction of Northern Ireland, and I think there is coming up. I think that we're going to see a lot. There is a great flowering of Irish novels on both sides of the borders, and we're going to see an awful lot coming up in the new year.
Yeah, the challenge for me for the Booker Prize for next year is to make space for voices around the world, which I think have lost out to American and British writers. Let's see what they come up with.
Indeed. Yeah, we'll have to see what comes next. But, yeah, and this is a book I'd happily give people for Christmas and all that. You know, that would be happy news for booksellers, no doubt.
I'm Lee Lendening, and in this month's We Need to Talk About podcast, our panel respond to Guardian supporter questions on extinction. How can conservation be balanced with the hunger for development? With finite conservation resources, how can we decide which species to save, and who should decide this? And what can we do to support biodiversity in our local area?
This is a massive economic assault by one species on the lives of all the other 8 to 10 million.
We look into pesticides and tourism, on the efforts to save the Sumatran orangutan, Dorset hedgehogs, Belizean national parks, and much more. That's We Need to Talk About Extinction. To have a listen, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Don't you sometimes wish you could be a fly on the wall when a writer sits with her editor and chats about the process behind the writing? Well, today you can, because that's what we have here when Kate Tempest dropped in with her poetry editor, the esteemed and brilliant poet in his own right, Don Patterson, to talk about her new collection of love poems, Running Upon the Wires. As they kicked back with a cup of tea, Don began by asking Kate how she's feeling about her book. Now it's out.
Yeah, it feels... I feel really good about it. I feel really glad that it's out. I feel kind of strangely sure that I did what I could with it and that now it's out.
You say that like you do always feel that when it's
something. No, I never feel that way. It's a very new thing. And I think like we talked about it so much as it was coming together, like the fact that it was going to be so tightly focused and in this vein that it is. It's a book of like love poems. Should say it charts heartbreak to new love with all the mess in between, and it doesn't ever pan out really. And I feel like because I knew that's what it was going to be, I feel quite happy that it's
no
that,
surprise
that it's that.
That's
yeah.
what it is. It's just that sometimes it's that thing, you know, when you get the book, it's like, because I mean, I don't know if you've had that before, but sometimes you get the book through the post and there's always that anticipation, and it's like it can't be the worst case of post-Christmas letdown ever, you know. It's just like, you know, or you open it on a typo and somebody tries to tell you that's good luck, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's already sort of tainted, so it's like, it's great that you feel good about it.
I've had a few of those when you don't feel completely sure that you did everything you wanted to do with it before it went off to be printed.
Yeah.
But with this, I feel a bit more chilled about it, like not to be at all you know, blasé about it. Still, when I held the book in my hand for the first time, it was like, you know, like quite an amazing moment, because that thing when you've seen a poem go from handwritten thing to, you know, an edited thing, suddenly then it's typed up and then it's sent off and then it's changed and then it's set into the manuscript and then suddenly it's on a page in an actual book. Like,
I did wonder if there'd be a difference for you this time though, because you know, because the voice itself throughout the book is more interior than people would normally associate with you. You know what I mean? It's less sort of performative in that way, you know. So there's therefore maybe a kind of bigger threshold between it becoming public, as it were, you know. And I wondered if, you know, if you'd experience a glitch, you know, when you. But no,
I feel really chilled about it. Yeah. But I think that because with other work, once it's a book, that's not the be all and end all of it. Like, it still has to be a tour, or it has to be a performance of some sort. It has to be. There needs something else needs to happen for the thing to come alive. Whether that's a performance on my part or on the part of the reader, it has to be kind of this quite intense engagement with it. But with this, I feel like I wrote these poems to live like this, and now they live like this.
Yeah,
so even talking about it so much makes you think I probably do feel more nervous than I'm letting on. Like,
it's kind of interesting because the situation you're in now is much closer to the one I tend to find myself in, you know,
yeah.
which is like, you know, where the performance doesn't have that relationship to the book, you know. You know, but in my case, the performance is a way of killing the book stone dead. You know, it's like
that's not
it's
true. I've
kind
seen
of grudging.
Before.
Oh, you, but it's but you know, it's like a grudging sales pitch for the book, sort of thing. You know, but I mean, it's just because the book, as you say, is a thing.
Yeah.
You know, so it's kind of odd feeling because it's quite an external thing to you. You know, it's like an object. It's like.
But do you have moments when you're composing or conceiving poems, or however you like to think of how it's happening, when you? Do you have any hunger for the poem to be performed outside of the page in the book?
Sometimes I want people to hear it, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, but that's usually a bad instinct. It's usually because I'm chuffed with myself, you know. I'm proud of some line that I've just written, which usually means it's terrible, you know. And I want to tell the world, you know, to just show them how clever I am. And that's usually, it's not always a good sign if that's what I feel, weirdly, but it's taken a long time to realise that. But I do... I don't know if you do this, but I do test all the lines out against the air just to see if they're working. I wouldn't know if it was just in my head. I need to speak them aloud, you know, to see if they have any musical integrity, I suppose.
Yeah.
Did you find yourself doing that? Well, you would do as a matter of course anyway, being a performer as well.
Yeah, but also not even with my own poems, like whenever I'm reading other people's poems.
Really?
I read them out loud. I just think you should. I think as a rule, you should read poetry aloud because your ear will pick up on things that your eye will skip over. And I reckon, yeah, that the poets, I'm pretty sure that all poets will be listening to the words. They'll say them out loud at least, you know, once or twice, just to get a sense of, as you say, the kind of the musical integrity of it, the sonics of it. There's so much more that you discover when you about a poem, or even when you're reading like anything. Something, a line jumps out to you, and you end up just saying it out loud anyway. You know, if a line really hits you, you end up speaking it.
Like. Yeah. I find out like lines of dialogue in a film are the same way. If it struck me as particularly brilliant, you know, I play it again, or I find myself mouthing it, and it's the same with a poem. And I think it's because as soon as you sort of you get to perform it, you know, it has that whole kind of sort of intonational dimension to it that carries all the intention and the feeling and the real kind of meaning behind it, not just the semantics of it. You know, you get a chance to kind of inhabit it as a piece of kind of living human speech in a way that's quite, you know.
So Don Patterson, you teach poetry and you and you edit poetry and you work with poets. What is there something that you wish that your students and your poets knew already? Is there something that you just wish that, you know, is there something that you wish your students knew already?
I wish I knew it wasn't a career, you know, and I don't, and you know, I'm it's only semi-facetious, you know, but I don't think it is. It's a kind of weird job. I've got friends who work in other art forms, and they do a 9-to-5 or some version of that, you know. Like visual artist friend of mine starts work at 8 o'clock in the morning, knocks off at 6 at night every day, you know. Novelists take off their 2,000 words, whatever, you know. But the poetry is nothing like that. It's not something that you can do, I find anyway, on a daily basis. I mean, you can do other stuff related to it, but to write poetry every day just seems like a one-way route to the asylum. I can't imagine why you would want to. So it's not really like other kinds of artistic practice, I think. I think that's something I wish they knew. And I'm slightly worried, I suppose, you know, that they've been encouraged to think otherwise recently. I don't know quite how this has come about. I mean, I tend to blame everyone on social media, like the old git I am, you know. I barely know what it is, but, you know, all social media. But for some reason, they've been encouraged to think that it's, you know, a career.
And is that a new, that seems like a new thing in them?
Yeah. My current position is, I used to say it was a vacation, but I think it's a disease. What do you think?
I don't know. I'm kind of interested in what you're saying about this thing about it not being something that you can do every day. And if you were to do that, it's a one-way ticket to the asylum. That's a very, it's, for me, it's quite reassuring to hear that from you. It's like, because you get, because as a working writer, you know, you have your deadlines and you have your things that you have to do. And as you say, you've got these other things that you'll be working on that keep the poetry in quite a sacred space.
Ideally, you know? Yeah.
You go and do the kind of longer pieces. For me, it's music or something. Music is very instinctive and it's like a real refresher. It zeroes everything. I can go at any point, at any time of the day or night, I can go and make music. That's fine. And like writing fiction, it's harder. And it involves you in a different way. You can't really fit that in between other things. But to hear you say that, even for you, poetry happens kind of what, on its own terms? When is it time for you to write then, if it's not a daily thing?
I used to sort of try and figure it out so I could do that thing again, you know, and light the incense and shake the bells and recreate the circumstances of the last decent poem, and I hope it. But it's never like that. I mean, I've just gone 4 years without writing a line. And I just started like 2 or 3 months ago. And I don't know why, you know, just like apart from the usual, you know, sort of, you know, recent traumatic experiences, you know, but those come up regularly and sometimes they're unproductive, you know. I mean, life's always going to happen to you, so there's always stuff to write about. But I don't know what the pattern of it is. I don't know why you stop and start.
What kind of relationship do you have with your editor?
It's good, you know, but I don't get much feedback.
You're in a class of your own.
I think it's because he makes a mistake in thinking that I know what I'm doing.
but you know. So at that stage, at your stage in this, who do you count among your peers? Do you feel like you have a network of contemporaries that you can, like, speak with or...
I've got a lot of friends, you know, who do the same thing, but usually when we get together, we speak about money or something, you know.
Yeah, it's just like, it's real life.
It's, but it's kind of funny. I think it happens. It's the case that, and it's often the case that you feel kind of increasingly sort of isolated in your art, I think, as you get older. Inevitably. And I think partly because people do assume you know what you're doing, whereas you don't really if you're doing it right. You're always going back to kind of scorched earth. You're always coming back to the blank page. You're always kind of trying to forget how you do it so you won't do it the same way twice, you know? And it's then that you do kind of need to, I'm being facetious, I do have the support of some good friends working, you know, sort of in poetry. It's true. But, you know, maybe not, I don't talk to them about it as much as I should. I think it's healthy for poets to talk to other poets. I think they always have. Do you have a circle that you share work around?
Well, I feel like I've got, it's really reassuring, by the way, to hear you say that. If you're doing it right, you never know what you're doing. You know, that doesn't get, in some ways it's reassuring, in other ways it's terrifying to think that it doesn't get any more, doesn't get any easier. But yeah, I feel like within my creative universe, I feel extremely lucky to have lots of, peers, contemporaries, like, also, when you're working on things, and I'm working on projects, if you're working on an album, you're working with musicians or you're working with a producer. If you're working on a play, you're working with actors and, you know, a director. It's all really collaborative. With poetry, it's for me, it was always very communal because it happened in public spaces and it happened out loud, like in poetry events, spoken word events. But then also, like, I have the benefit of running my ideas past you and having a conversation about the work as it begins to take shape, which I feel like is the most, it's an incredible thing to have somebody give your work this attention. Like, I feel very lucky. And I also have that kind of relationship with other people that I work with, you know, where you kind of trust each other enough to go into a conversation about work before it's ready to be seen. Like, I remember when I sent you the first poems from what became Running Up on the Wires, and I was really umming and ahhing about it, like, oh, am I ready to let somebody see what, and I just thought, well, this is what I'm working on. Like, at some stage I'm gonna have to find out whether there's any legs in this. And then I just remember, like, pressing send and being like, oh god, I've sent done these poems about my heartbreak, like. But then just having a conversation about the poetics of the poems, like whether they have, you know, any weight to them, or what about them is working and what isn't. Suddenly it's like this amorphous, terrifying world of unmade work. You know, it could be anything.
It's funny that you find yourself have these rather kind of cold, almost, I mean, sometimes in my case, psychotically cold conversations, editorial conversations, about, you know, line breaks, metaphors and what have you, you know, when the subject matter itself is often so intense and traumatic and, you know, sort of, and sometimes disturbing with an author, you know, it's just like, but yet you're both in that position, you're going, you know, it's just, yeah, if you swap these two words around, you know, and you cut out the murder in the third stanza, and I think it'll work. I think that will, you know, put the murder there, I think it works better.
I feel like it's the only way you could do it, because, like, at that stage, what you're both looking at then, you're looking at the craft of it. So it's not therapy, you know, you're not talking to someone who's going to read the poem and suddenly give you a solution about the themes within the poem, but you're talking to someone who can help you improve your craft, like, and to think about things in a different way so that you can take a step back and try and understand what it is that you're trying to put together in a broader sense, like, as poems, that, do they belong together in a collection? How do they sit on the page? All this stuff, this is stuff that I never thought about till I started having conversations with you about poetry.
Yeah, it's all that thing about how it communicates and what it is exactly that you want it to communicate and what you think it says and what it actually says. You know, it's just like, I find that a really interesting conversation, you know.
I've got a question for you. At what stage within your life with poetry do you feel like you understood poetry?
The cool and diplomatic and you know, I am not an arsehole answer would be, I still don't understand poetry, but that wouldn't be true. I think there will have been a day when I was like 42 or something like that. It was a horrible day, because I've been thinking about nothing else for the last 20 years pretty solidly, and I have an interest in this technical side of it and how it communicates, you know, how metaphor works, all that sort of stuff. I picked up a book of poems and I couldn't enjoy it anymore because it was like the Matrix. All I could see were streaming digits, you know, and I could see and I could see what was wrong with it, and I could see how that metaphor worked, and I could see how you'd fix that line because the meter was a bit off and what have you, you know, and I can see how as a gestalt this bit wasn't working and what have you. But I couldn't really enjoy it anymore, you know. And I think there's a danger with too close an acquaintance with your own craft that sometimes it's difficult to be a punter. You know, and I find it really tough to enjoy poetry, I think, because of my professionalised kind of engagement with it. And that wasn't a great day. And I had to decide then how I was going to keep enjoying it, you know. And that meant going back to, those handful of things that I still loved, you know, and making a point of rereading these, you know, sort of religiously, you know, every year, you know, just to kind of root myself in it again.
What were you reading? What were the things you were reading?
Things like reading out four quartets in the bath once every 3 months, I think, is a good thing to do. If I need to remind myself how poetry goes, you know, I'll read that, or I'll read Heaney, or I'll read Bishop, you know, in a small resonant room in my home. What about you? You're still loving it? Not suggesting it'll ever change, you know, but it's just, I think it's an interesting thing.
I feel like I don't understand it. You know, I'm not at a point with it where I feel like there's so much to learn. I genuinely feel like every time I hear something or I read something, I don't understand why it's having the effect on me that it's having, or like I can't work out in my own work why that's happened or what. There's so many questions around so much of it.
But I do wonder whether there's any real connection between understanding it and actual and writing the stuff. You know, I don't feel any more able to write it because I understand it better. It's kind of really strange. And I can understand
it's more like it's a different hat that understands it. It's not Don the poet that understands. It's Don the academic or the teacher or the.
Maybe, you know. Yeah. I mean, hopefully the poet's been the beneficiary. But on my darker days, I do wonder if it would have been better just keeping the whole thing kind of intuitive, you know. I mean, I think the idea is that you train your intuition to make better decisions, you know, and you can do that quite consciously, the same way you do by learning an instrument. But just maybe you can take it too far, you know. I mean, I think keeping that innocent, childlike, engaged, creative part of you alive as a poet is just crucial if you're going to keep writing and writing well.
Hope so.
So do you think there are any alternatives in terms of the well of inspiration to finding trouble for a poet?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the way that you experience existence is very particular for a poet. Like I've talked about this before, I feel like it's about having your senses tuned in to a particular frequency. I feel like this with people that are musicians as well, I suppose, a slightly different frequency, or people that I know who are creatively driven. It's about how you're affected by experience, and also about how you push yourself to experience in the most full way possible. Because there's this sensitivity about you which is engaging with life at a particular frequency. It's the only way I can really describe it, and it's so vague, but I feel like when you least expect it to, a poem happens out of all the mess and all the confusion and all the beauty. And basically what you're dealing with is 80% of the time difficult, overwrought feeling and confusing understandings of your place in the world or what's happening around you. And 20% of the time turns into poetry, which is wonderful when you seek to give it out to people to try and make sense of things, because not everybody has their senses open at that frequency, and a lot of people can't connect with their own feelings in that way. It's not safe for them to do that. They don't have time in their lives. They're not that way. And so for those of us that are, I feel like it's a kind of obligation to go fully into that and try and create something out of it,
Do you think that's a dangerous frequency to tune into, though? Do you think, you know, because you talk about sort of, you know, the 20% of the time and the chaos and the mess, you know, of actually getting some poetry out of it. But it does pose the question, you know, to what extent one seeks chaos and mess in order to increase your statistical chances of getting a poem. It's like that thing. Well, you know, it's,
life,
it's you know. I can't remember. Who was it talked about? Sort of, it's like getting, you know, just like it's like getting struck by lightning, but you can increase your chances by standing outside in a thunderstorm, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm interested in the connection about whether even unconsciously, poets, because they're good on that frequency, do tend to tune in very deliberately to that frequency in a way that isn't maybe also always that constitutionally healthy.
Yeah, I mean, it's damning, isn't it, to think
so
about it.
So this heavy turn, there's supposed to be a cheery wee conversation.
I mean, that was the point of a cheery conversation. No, I think, like, if you think about, the kind of havoc that this vocation, like wreaks on your life, it's definitely not the kind of thing that you put down at the end of the day and come home to your loved ones, like, able to be a normal human being. It's like, it's with you all the time. And that sometimes means that you're not with yourself because you're with this thing. You're with the poetry or you're elsewhere. You're thinking about things or you're feeling something, you're processing something, you're writing, you know, it can take you into, you know, it can be extremely selfish, this job. I think any creative job, when I speak to people, because I have this kind of belief that creativity is extremely important for mental health and that it's very important for people to allow themselves to express themselves in that way, and that actually the kind of culture of the genius is what's, and the culture of the expert and this thing that we have here in the West about poetry and music being something that belongs to a kind of genius group. But actually, I believe quite strongly that it should be part of everyday life and that it doesn't matter if you can't play Mozart on the piano, it's really healthy just to have to make some sound. Anyway, so I've got this. This is part of my kind of...
But there is a qualitative difference between that and, as you say, responsibility to talent. You know?
Yeah, 100%.
And as you say, it does take you away. I mean, I always think that's maybe why a lot of poets I know are really into cop shows, you know, because they can identify with that thing where the phone goes off in the middle of the night and it's like, I got to take this, you know, we'll get back to that, you know, but work needs me, you know.
But when I talk to people, and I've been talking to people about that, about like just kind of giving yourself permission to write a poem, like even if it's not going to be a poem for anyone else to hear, giving yourself permission to sit with your feelings and describe them in some way. A lot of people that they have explained to me that they feel it's extremely selfish and that they don't want to, especially if they're mothers, they've got kids or families or you know, fathers. And I think that there is something hard to balance because you have this, like, this idea that you're communicating with your higher self, which kind of allows you to see it in a different light, that it's not selfishness. You're doing this for this kind of bigger purpose, you know. But really is it for that? Like, when I think about it, like, This thing about being kind of waiting for the phone to ring or whatever, and I've got to take this, you know. There is definitely a question that I have to ask myself about, at what point are you serving the work, your community, creativity in general, the muse? At what point are you just serving yourself? Like, it's a hard thing. Like, I never used to.
I don't think it's either or. I think it's often both, you know. And I think it's sometimes that weird position where the ego is useful, and as much as it'll drive you to the gig, and then but when you're there, you got to do it. You got to have the wherewithal to actually do the gig. But it does serve some purpose. So I think it can be both. Although I do make a sort of, you know, I think there is a difference between, you know, sort of that therapeutic use of the creative and stuff like that, and the other stuff. I think. I don't know.
The work. Yeah, initially, well, we were looking at a way to structure it. And remember, I was trying to find like an organising principle for it. And initially, like, I thought of, I tried a few different things and it just wasn't working. It wasn't right. Seasons or something to show that it was moving through a year.
Remember that? Yeah.
And it was just wasn't right. It felt like a bit heavy-handed, a bit hammy, like. And then also I found out recently about Stag's Leap, which I hadn't read before, which is structured that way. But then when the inspiration hit me, that obviously it had to begin at the end. I mean, it's so simple, isn't it? It's just such a simple thing to open the conceit is so simple, but it's so satisfying to open the book and the first thing you see is the end.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what you know when you're going into a relationship. That's what you know is about to happen. You go into the relationship, you open the book, the first thing you see is the end. You know it's going to happen.
It makes you realise how thrall you are to these old ways of seeing things, you know, these standard conceits that would fit everything into. And it takes a lot to break them, yeah.
And you persist anyway, regardless. You kind of, you still go for it, even though, you know,
it's
doomed. Anyway, this is a poem from the section of the book which is called The Beginning, but it comes at the end. And it's called I Don't Want to Go Backwards With Her Anymore. I Want to Go Forwards With You. I feel you going quiet in my company. I know you're thinking of her, or thinking of me, thinking of her. There's a decoration from our wedding cake still hanging from the rearview mirror of my car. Her letters are in my bedside drawer. I take the decoration down and throw it out. I put her letters in a box. My sentences begin, "Trust me, baby, I've got it all worked out." At which point I see your eyes and everything dies in my mouth. I'm learning to recognise each pitch in the scale of your silence.
How do you feel about intimacy? I mean, in a theoretical way.
I think that it's funny because people, when I've spoken to people about this book in like interviews or whatever, you know, the angle seems to be, oh, this is unusual for you, this is a new direction.
Yeah.
But actually, in Hold Your Own, there were very intimate poems. Yeah. There were poems that addressed lovers and sexuality. And in Everything Speaks in Its Own Way, which was a self-published collection, also there was loads of very small love poems and poems about intimacy. But they were just kind of tempered against these kind of bigger, more outward-reaching poems that, I mean, they're still pretty intimate, some of them. They're still dealing with kind of small internal moments. Let Them Eat Chaos was all.
But the concentration in this book is very different, isn't it? And
yeah, 100%.
And it seems to have been sort of amplified by the way that it's structured. Because it has a narrative kind of arc to it.
When I sent you a load of poems, there were like intimate love poems, and then there was a few kind of political poems in there as well. And you said, take these out and let's keep them to the love poems. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I felt you were protecting yourself. Or something, you know what I mean? It was just like there was nothing wrong with them, but it felt like a sort of carapace, you know.
Yeah, I thought that was when you came back saying like I think you know like it would be more interesting I think if we were able to just like maintain the focus, and it's what I wanted to do, but I didn't feel brave enough until we discussed that, and I thought okay, cool, like I can. I kind of gave myself permission to go through with something that I wanted to do, but it was helpful.
I think that's why
for
me as well, it's just like, you know, sort of the editorial thing is so kind of important, because it's about the author being lent the courage of their own convictions, I think, you know, and just and talking about what those are and saying, no, this is, you must do this, you know.
Yeah. I feel like with the poems, obviously some of them are extremely intimate. They're addressed to lovers. Well, they're very closely attached to moments.
But it's an unusual book, isn't it? In that it doesn't follow the usual kind of, you know, sort of, decline and fall, the end, you know. It's just like, it strikes me as much more true to life, because it's about the way one relationship moves into another. And I was struck by the fact that you just don't read much on this subject at all. You know, we tend to I hate sort of cheap metaphors. You know, the life is a journey kind of things. It drives me crazy. It's just life isn't a fucking journey. It just isn't. And
it's
also the lies that it's the lies that we tell each other about. Sort of, you know, sort of how, you know, the novelization of our own relationships, and it's just not true. And yours strikes me as a much more kind of honest look at what really happens to the heart. You know, sort of, and you can still mourn, but at the same time be feeling something else coming alive.
Man,
in you.
It's a messy time. I think like the idea of writing past the heartbreak and trying to get a clearer perspective, because so much of the powerful love poetry or the powerful music created around heartbreak is that it's the Heartbreak album, or it's the kind of, but I felt really, really strongly that it had to move through that, past that, into a new love. But yeah, as you say, reflecting the confusion, it's never as clear as that's over, I'm completely healed, I'll move on. For me anyway, it's never that clear, and in this situation it wasn't. So I thought that was a more useful thing to put out for people. Like, you know, I believe that it has to be useful at some... It has to feel useful.
I think it's so much more useful than, you know, sort of telling folk the same old lies about closure, you know, whatever, you know. I mean, there's a lousy metaphor for you. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
You don't get closure, you know.
But I feel like when I'm going to perform these tomorrow, I'm going to read them out, and usually when I approach the stage and approach a reading, it's like I feel... like something beyond me is going to happen, like something beyond the audience, something's going to happen to us all, which is kind of bigger than any of us, but wouldn't happen without any of us. It's this it's very powerful for me, performance. I feel like it takes me somewhere, and in its best moments it takes me somewhere indescribable, but I feel completely sure that that's definitely not going to happen tomorrow. I'm not going to be in performance. I'm just going to be reading the poems out and trying to stay true to the story that the poems tell. And I hope that what happens is that somebody in the audience is going to recognise their own mess, you know. But, and I think that's a much more humble hope than what I usually go into performance
with. It's risky,
with.
Isn't it? Because you don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I anticipate too that'll be the case, actually, you know, but you don't know, and that's the risk.
Yeah.
The risk is they're going to go, no, that's just you. I don't know what you're talking about. It's just you, thanks to that. Oh.
Yeah.
But
also that people might come to a gig, like, you know, wanting, with an expectation of a performance, and then what's going to happen is a kind of slow, quiet reading through these poems about intimacy. But I think there's a different payoff for that, because what then happens for people is a connection to their, wherever they're at with their own thing. I mean, I hope so anyway. I hope that people will find a use for this stuff. Otherwise, what are we making poems for? You know?
Kate Tempest's Running Upon the Wires is published by Picador. Don Patterson's The Fall at Home is with Faber, who also published Milkman by Anna Burns. Next week, we're joined by Kieran Millwood-Hargrave and Jesse Burton to discuss their forays into the forests of fairy tales. Turns out, the originals are often grim, but not for the reasons we thought. Until then, as ever, please subscribe and review us wherever you get your podcasts, and join the discussion on Twitter @GuardianBooks or by leaving a comment on the podcast page. But for now, from me, Richard Lee, and our producer, Susanna Tresillian, thanks and bye-bye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.